Blog Talk Radio.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And hello and good morning once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese, and it's another week of American Tennis. And every week we bring a different guest on and a different topic about athletics, college athletics, tennis, and you name it. We always say that whatever you've got to say, stand up, speak out. Say what needs to be said out there, folks. This is the United States of America. Just stay professional, address issues, not people. You can say pretty much what you need to, but nobody can find fault if you just address issues, not people. But all that it takes for evil to prosper, for good people to do nothing, Edmund Burke is one of the best sayings out there, I think. And we need to speak up and sort of talk about what's going on. So every week we address something different. We got a program this week that addresses more than just tennis. We're going to talk about athletics in the United States and college athletics in particular and what the heck is going on. I know anybody that listens to the program, you know where I'm coming from. I try to tell it straight up, but, you know, I've been told I'm old school, well, old-fashioned old school, I don't care, but it's the right way, and we're all sort of confused what's going on with sports today. But today, our guest is, I call him Coach Bill Emmendorfer. It's Bill Emmendorfer. Actually, he's the father of one of my former players, and I've got to say before I put him on the line here, I see he's on the switchboard here, but recruiting his son, I think most of the coaches out there were sort of afraid to go approach. And I remember in Louisville, Kentucky, going to see Bill. I'm going to put him on here so he can tell the story right if we do it right. Bill, I got you there, don't we? You on?
We do. You do. You got me, Chuck.
Okay. All right. All right. You remember in Louisville, Kentucky, right? National clay courts. Yeah. And you know what? Addressed, you know, I know there were two or three really tough kids there playing at the same time, and one of them was your son, Brad Emmendorfer, and I, you know, I'd heard about Brad's training and everything over in Knoxville area, and I went up, but somebody told me, yeah, but you got to get past his dad first, and I'd had some experience in recruiting, so I know, though, that as protective as we a lot of times are, I know how much fathers love their sons, but anyhow, well, listen, I'm going to get on with this in a minute, but Bill, let me just talk a little bit about you. Now, correct me if I mess this up a little bit, but I saw you play football in against Florida, I think, at Tennessee, University of Tennessee, 1971, in the fall of 71, Doug Dickey had just decided to leave, I think. You know, he was your coach, and then you got to play under the great Bill Battle as well. So you were all SEC offensive lineman. For 4 years, University of Tennessee was in top 10 in the country, so you guys were always there in the top. I remember how everybody loved Vol football and still do, but you've been through it from that angle, you know, and then and growing up with it. And, so let me get this right. You went on and you became a dentist after that, right? You were a dentist for how many years?
Well, I've had a long, circuitous career in a lot of things, Chuck. Actually, the game was in 1970, and we played Florida. And at that game, I was actually playing defensive tackle. And that year, we ended up fourth in the nation. Should have, could have, would have won the national championship, but we didn't. And ended up winning the Sugar Bowl, and Nebraska won the national championship, beat LSU in the Orange Bowl. And had we gone to the Orange Bowl, I think we would have won the national championship, but we'll never know. But that was a great team. That team that year, we ended up fourth in the nation. We set the NCAA record in takeaways. We had 57 takeaways in 11 games.
That's
and had eight more in the Sugar Bowl. We had 65 takeaways in 12
That's
games.
That's unbelievable.
And that record will never be broken just because the rules of the game today. That record, in recent history, teams get about – a great team gets about 40 takeaways in a year. We
right.
had eight interceptions against Alabama that year in that game. And that team was a unique team and been a unique group of guys. It's a bygone era, and four of us off that team have earned doctorates. And my roommate from college, my other best friend, and then another guy who's now deceased all have doctorates. So four of us have doctorates off that team. And so it was unique. And we probably weren't the best athletes, but we didn't make mistakes. And you know, the old adage, the team that makes the fewest mistakes wins. And in any sport, you show me the box scores, and I can usually predict who wins. In a tennis match, you almost don't need to see the match. If I look at unforced errors, I'm going to figure
absolutely.
Out who wins the match.
Absolutely true. You wouldn't believe I spent 4 hours yesterday. You know, we got cut the other day, and I don't want to talk about but we had a tough loss, and I've been figuring out the same thing, the stats, but it's always about errors. It's always about beating yourself in sports. But go ahead, Bill. Finish there, what you said.
So anyway, so I was fortunate enough to play on that team, played defensive tackle and then played offensive guard the last 2 years, played with great guys. The worst we finished was ninth in the country. You know, we lost five games in college, lost one game we probably should have lost. One team was better than us. The rest of them, we had stuff happen. We lost to Alabama my senior year, held them to 126 yards total offense, and lost the game in a game we're going to win, and we get a fumble going down to kick the winning field goal to win. We're going to win 13-10. We fumble. They win 17-10. But you know what? We'll get into athletics. Athletics change. You're talking about recruiting Brad. Everybody thought Brad was going to Tennessee. I was close to Coach Dickey. Coach Dickey was the athletic director, close to the university. Brad was training in Knoxville. You know, the best thing that happened to Brad is not going to Tennessee. These kids got to be their own person. It's hard. You've got an adage, Chuck. You give your children roots and you give them wings, and it's a lot easier to give them roots than it is wings. And I'm going through that
That's
right now
sure.
with grandson, who I'm really struggling trying to figure out kind of the mindset of his college coach. And as a guy that coached and deals with athletes and deals with motivation every day, I'm trying to figure the thing out, trying to figure the guy out. As a guy who is a fixer, it's hard for me to not get involved, but I'm not. It's not my place. It's not
no,
my
no,
role.
No. We can't. We could talk about that, too, with parents. Parents got a parent. And as from the outside in, all we can hope is that our kids have the same type of experience we had. And people out there asking why we got this all-SEC, first-team all-SEC football player on here, but we had a great conversation about 2 weeks ago when we were up there at the University of Tennessee playing, and I just thought you have some tremendous insights on what is going on with college athletics. And I talk about tennis every week, and three or four of the recent shows have been, Bill, about college tennis. And every time I talk to a college coach, they say we're handcuffed, and we don't get to practice enough. And they're making us play these abbreviated scoring matches. You know, I've probably had 30 shows in the past 5 or 6 years on trying to help people understand how bad it is to abbreviate our sport and to cut it up like we are for whatever good reason, and how we're just making so many mistakes at the grassroots. This morning, a friend of mine told me that the USTA, for example, and it's not a slam on the people who work there, but any bureaucracy, they said they were always used to preach about grassroots. Well, they put big canvas over all the grassroots, and they're smothering them by too much top-down management. But anyhow, we were talking about this a couple weeks ago, and I said, listen, I've got to get you on the program. Because what I'd like for you to do, Bill, if you can, just talk about, you know, how simple it was back, you know, in the 60s and the 70s in so many ways. It was an educational endeavor. I put up here why I'm bringing you on. I put, has sports entertainment become more important than the education, entertainment over education, no value that sports, first of all, were created to give. We want all our children to have that experience that they can talk about for their life, not just the glory, but what they've learned. So what does it hold for the future of non-revenue sports, too, like tennis? Today, well, we got Bill Emdorfer. Okay, so, Bill, maybe you could start, talk about some how simple was the simplicity. Didn't you have we had a freshman rule. You could not play. The folks out there, you got to understand, we could not play. Bill, what was it, about 1975 they changed that? Could you talk about just how it was going in at that point for you, and then we'll talk about some other stuff.
Yeah, there's a couple things. One, back in the day, you weren't in basketball and football, in your revenue sports, you weren't eligible to compete as a freshman. In your non-revenue sports, you were, actually, but back in your revenue sports, you weren't. And so that was one thing, which really was good, because I don't see how these kids graduate early and go to college early and do all that, but it gave you a time to transition into college as a student athlete, as a student, and it gave you time to get adjusted. But the flip side of that is they had a lot of scholarships, and in a lot of ways you were kind of cannon fodder for the varsity, and they didn't care. I mean they cared, but they didn't care because they had so many numbers that if you got hurt, you got hurt, and we had a number, just move them over. We redshirted 40 kids a year, and you know, you have 40 red shirts, and we had 45 freshmen and 40 red shirts, and another 100 on the varsity, and you know, you had strength in numbers, particularly the haves. The haves had a lot of depth, and the have-nots had a depth problem, but not as great as it is today. So the deal was, you had a chance to transition, you had a chance to adjust to college, you played an abbreviated schedule, about a 5-game schedule, and you practiced, and you learned what was going on, and that's what happened. And so that transition was good, both in developing you from a high school kid, from a kid to an independent person in college, and that transition. And heck, in the late 60s and early 70s, it was a tumultuous time in this country anyway, making that transition to college. Anyway, you had Vietnam, you had racial issues, you had another. I mean, I played with the first African-American athlete at the University of Tennessee, the first African-American captain in an SEC school, the first African-American quarterback in the SEC. We were truly – Tennessee at that time truly had set the standard that most schools in the South had not set, and it put us heads and shoulders from a competitive standpoint ahead of a lot of programs. But, you know, things were more simple in one way. The other way is the things we did – in today's world, they'd probably put coaches in jail. I mean, the brutality of the game was different. And we weren't as good of athletes as these kids. We didn't have the nutrition. We didn't have all the other things. But the pure brutality of the game was much worse. And there were no limits. I mean, a 20-hour limit, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, you'd practice, and if you didn't get it right, you'd practice more. And there were times you'd practice three times a day. And you know, there were times when, you know, you would hit every day. I mean, you'd hit on Wednesdays. I mean, today you barely hit during the week. Back then, it was a fight every day. So, and I'm not sure all that was bad. I mean, I understand safety in the game, but I understand becoming mentally tough. I understand persevering beyond what you think you can endure, and I understand the process and the benefits of what we gained. When I applied to dental school, I was the first person in my family to go to college. And had not been for intercollegiate athletics, I probably would have gone to college, but I surely wouldn't have had the opportunities that were afforded to me as an athlete at a major football power. I had the privilege of both playing football and wrestling in college. I wrestled my freshman year, and then I had the injury and didn't. But the reality is those experiences. So when I interviewed for dental school, I was kind of on the cusp. I was on the bubble. Let me put it that way. So I was either going to get in or not get in. And when I interviewed, the chairman of the admissions committee said, "Mr. Emmendorfer, did you think about maybe quitting football and concentrating more on academics?" And I looked at him and I said, "Dr. Jolly, I appreciate that." I said, "But the lessons I learned in athletics will serve me much better than the lessons I learned in the classroom. And if I don't get in dental school because of that, so be it. But I'm better because of what I did in athletics."
Okay, Bill, can I jump in there? That's great. So that helped you get in. But what you just said is profound, but a lot of people out there would be saying, what, the lessons learned in athletics? More important, the lessons in the classroom? What is your take on that? And then I'll tell you my take on it, if I could jump in afterwards. Go ahead. What's your take on that? Why?
Well, what I've learned in the environment that I've had the privilege to be in, the people I get to associate with have been good for me, and it allows me to grow in a lot of ways, socially and otherwise, be able to speak, to be able to introduce, be in a crowd, be able to do things. But the lessons you learn, I mean, quite honestly, I probably don't use physiology a whole lot every day. I probably don't use biochemistry a whole lot every day. Now, the discipline of going through those things and understanding the principles are good, but I understand the leadership things that I learned by being a captain of a top 10 football team. I understand the lessons I learned on discipline and hard work and perseverance. I understand the lessons of overcoming adversity, and those are the lessons that tend to make you successful in any aspect of life. And it's those things that I learned. And then the other thing is, you know, and something that, and I'm going to skip around just a little bit, something that's a little bit of a misnomer because of the NIL stuff and everything.
I'll come back to that, but go ahead. Talk about it. We'll refer to it.
People talk about money and things, but the great ones for the love of the competition and the love of the sport. You can't be great if you're doing it for the money. I mean, you can be. Some people have so much natural ability they can be really good, but the great ones, it's a passion, it's a love, it's an undenying desire to be the very best at what you're doing, and we've monetized that, and we'll get into that later because we've kind of screwed it up. But anyway, the deal is, people that excel at it have a passion for what they do. Now, getting back on the NCAA and the 20-hour rule and whatever they're doing, I understand these kids need to be student-athletes. Trust me, I do. And maybe the NCAA's missed that point, or maybe we're about to miss that point going forward. But the deal is, you can't do anything 20 hours a week, and you can't do anything with limitations and become great at it. You know, the people that are great at anything have this desire, this passion, this thing that you can't put a time or a value or whatever on that's just different. You know, there's a kid at Tennessee right now, this Dalton Kennett kid, who's kind of been the white mamba of college basketball. The kid shoots 5,000 shots every day after practice. He's going to be player of the year in the SEC. He came from northern Colorado. He went to junior college for 2 years, came from Northern Colorado. That kid didn't get from a junior college to the number one player in the SEC in a lottery pick without a passion and a desire that's different than anybody else. And so whether you look at the great tennis players, I mean, look at the great tennis players. I mean, you know, Djokovic plays tennis in a friggin' swimming pool. I mean, we got kids that if their mama doesn't drive them to the country club and if they don't have the right outfit on, they can't play tennis. And so we kind of missed the point. I don't mean that to be derogatory.
If I could jump in there, the way to sum it up, I call it the dumb down. It's the NCAA dumb down, okay? Now, you cannot legislate excellence. You cannot legislate excellence. Very often on the program, Bill, I've talked about three things. It's God-given ability or nature. It's the opportunities that you're given. That is nurture. And then the third part is self. The ability, opportunity, desire, nature, nurture, self. Those all three, folks, are the most important. That's what he's talking about. Our huge mistake that we need to talk about here, what we're doing is we're dumbing it down, okay? We have over-emphasized talent, the God-given talent. I heard Dabo Swinney the other day on his show. It's really good, folks. The first press talk conference he had is on YouTube, Bill. It's about their first practice, but he talks briefly about a couple things, but he says, in the athlete, what you said about the guy that's in at Tennessee now, the commitment must be greater than the talent, he says. If the talent's greater than the commitment, it ain't going to fly. It ain't going to work, and that burns out. And now what my fear is, Bill, that we are setting up a dumbed-down situation, and whether we are just so afraid that somebody's going to get sued or it's going to work too hard or something like that, you know, we're not incentivizing hard work and fortitude and the internal drive that a human being needs to have. We are dumbing it down to where it's basically how much talent this person has, and it's quite disgusting. Folks in tennis, the UTR, the WNTN, whatever that stuff that they do, that's what we're doing. That's what we're done. We're dumbing our – it's dumbed down scoring too. So, Bill – NCAA, you said, okay, they cannot legislate excellence. That's what they've been trying to do. So I took over there for a minute, Bill. I'm sorry, man. but go ahead. Get back in there, Bill. We need to hear what you have to say.
Let's talk about the NCAA. So the NCAA has been set up for the oversight of intercollegiate athletics for years. And you know, I think the NCAA had good intentions, but like most bureaucracies, they kind of somehow outgrow their usefulness or they lose sight of what their real function is. And so what happens is, and the paradigm's changing, and we're not going to be able to get the genie back in the bottle. So let's figure out what we need to do to address it. What happened to the NCAA, in my opinion, kind of sat back and let this change of things that occurred dictate to them how they were going to manage and police and legislate. So what happened, if you look at when I played back in the 50 years ago, there was about 3 games a week on television, period. You were on television about 4 times a year if you were a top 10 team. And then back when Georgia and Texas sued about the television rights and the television things opened up, then the revenue thing started to change. And the revenue in sports, and basically then you started the BCS. And so then the football programs took over BCS. It wasn't an NCAA thing. The NCAA makes their money basically off the basketball program. The football stuff is separate. Well, all of a sudden, what happened was the paradigm starts to shift, and now you've got this entertainment model, which is ESPN and ABC and Fox, and you've got these huge dollars. And you've got these dollars, and these dollars are going begrudging any of these people or what they make, because it's part of the entertainment industry now, there's no limits on what you can make. So we've got coaches making $10 million a year. We've got athletic directors making $2 million a year. We've got athletic directors and coaches making more than college presidents. And that's the going rate. That's the going rate. I'm not begrudging it. I'm just saying that somehow we've got the thing in the wrong perspective. So now you've got a financial model that all of a sudden the players say, where is our share? We're putting the product in, but we're getting books and tuition and meal money, and that's a little bit of an understatement, because most of these guys in the revenue sports at major colleges are living well. I mean, they're living very well. They're well catered to. They're well taken care of. In fact, one of the interesting things that occurred was during the pandemic, when minor league baseball cut out a lot of teams, college baseball got better. And with the emergence of college baseball and college softball on television, they became revenue generators. And now every of the major power schools, they have really nice stadiums. They're on television 3 to 5 times a week. They're generating revenue. They've increased the facilities. And because the NCAA hasn't changed their scholarships, they're getting athletes on NIL. So the deal that you got 11.5 scholarships doesn't really matter, because the major schools all have NIL deals to where they can get their players on NIL. So now the sports that can generate revenue, the sports that are high-profile sports, have become basically a free market. And so you've got free agency without contracts and without salary caps. And the NCAA kind of let this get ahead of them without having enough foresight in what this model would look like. And so they can talk about it's the Wild West, and it is, but it's become the Wild West because the NCAA wasn't forward-thinking to get ahead enough to figure out how to figure a plan that kind of works for everybody. And now how do you get the genie back in the bottle? We do the same thing in government. It's kind of what we've done in this country. We kind of try to close the barn door after the horse is out of the barn, and that's what we're doing now in intercollegiate athletics. It appears that the haves keep getting more, and the have-nots will keep getting less, and so as you get to the Super League, and I think it's almost inevitable, because the people with the money are going to dictate. It's the golden rule: he who has the gold makes the rules. And so the guys with the gold are going to make the rules. And the guys with the gold are going to be the Big Ten and the SEC and who they let in. And the rules are going to be made by the people who generate money. That's football, basketball, baseball, and softball. And then the other guys are either going to cease to exist or get the scraps. And if they get the scraps, they're going to get it because the school needs it, either because of Title IX or because of something else, or the sports are going to become kind of a brand tied to the university, but somewhat at arm's length from the university. And so, it's interesting because right now, I had someone tell me and someone in the know that one of the really good women's basketball programs in the country to compete with them in the SEC was going to be about a $3 million investment in NIL stuff for players.
Well, Bill,
and
go ahead.
No, so
Bill,
I mean,
I just want to jump in there real quick. Could you a solution to that? Okay, a solution to that. It's true, like you said, the genie's out of the bottle, or toothpaste out of the tube with the thing. But the NCAA, they are completely reactionary, just like our government's completely reactionary. Anything that is top-down management is always going to be reactionary, aren't they? So what can they do at this point? I wanted to bring up just a little thing off cuff here for people to understand. Folks, if your son or daughter is on a scholarship at most schools, it's worth about $60,000 a year. Your youngster is making $125 an hour because by the NCAA rules, you're allowed 24 weeks of practice, 20 hours a week, 480 hours divided into $60,000, $125. I think on the football thing I was listening to the other day, the average football player with all the perks they get with no NIL, they're making $125,000 a year in value. Now, folks, that's value. It's not look. It's not just free books and free this and free that. Somebody's paying for that. Boosters or somebody is going out and working on the farm or working in a mill or something to supply that money for those kids. But if you're making $125,000 an hour, you're basically making $250 an hour. You're making it's crazy. No one understands value. So it's the harm I'm worried about, Bill, is what's going to happen to these kids. When by the time they're 28, 29, it's going to be dried up unless they manage your money really, really well. And then all of a sudden they go, wait a minute. I was living off $250 an hour, $125. You're telling me I got to work a job for $20 an hour here? Whoa, wait a minute. Well, sorry, you're not qualified. Your education was not sufficient here, you know, son or young lady. You know, and what are we doing? We're going to create a whole generation, Bill, of people that have, my father used to say, it'll get you in trouble, the champagne taste on the beer budget. We're going to create a whole generation of people that are used to living high on the hog. And then, wait a minute, that's not the way when you're 35 years old, I don't think, you know, unless you've been trained through the hard work. So what could the NCAA do at this point, Bill? What's going to happen there?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. You know, obviously, elite athletes and elite programs have always been privileged to some degree. I mean, we were privileged 50 years ago. I mean, we were treated different because of who we were and what we were than the average person that was a student. There's no question about that. So we were privileged too. But a couple of things in today's world that's concerning is this transfer portal thing where I can just say, I'm not playing and I'm leaving, or I was an all-conference guard at Vanderbilt, but Alabama has an opening and I can get NIL and go to Alabama and start for them next year and they'll take me, or not start for them and still get my money. And so we've got to have some way to tie these athletes to a commitment for a finite period of time. You know, I'm not opposed to athletes being able to transfer if a coach changes, if a system changes. You know, being fair to the kid, I'm a drop back quarterback, and we get into a pass run option.
I don't think anybody is.
But the reality is, me just to say, you know what, I got a better deal at Ohio State, and I'm going to Ohio State, or there's a Maserati waiting for me at Georgia, and I'm going to Georgia, is wrong, and it's hard on the coaches, it's hard on everybody, but it's become more of an individual situation than it is a team situation. And fortunately, what you're seeing in a lot of cases, the teams that will make a deep run in the basketball tournament, the teams that will make a deep run in probably in the football playoffs, in most cases are seasoned teams that have veterans that have been in the trenches for a while, that have been together because there's something about age and maturity. But you can turn a program around
very good
quickly. I don't know that you can win a championship, but you can sure flip
very it good
pretty, two or three.
Right. And that's what they're doing, Bill. I've used an analogy, this transfer portal. You can go to the top. You know, okay, I'm going to use, of course, I follow Clemson sports, you know. But I heard, first of all, I don't want to forget this point, so I'm going to put it out there first of all. Dabo Swinney said something the other day. He said all they have to do is move up the signing date for high school kids, you know, 2-3 months before the transfer portal. And let the transfer portal folks, it's okay to transfer. You got to sit out a year if it's not for a good reason. I don't know. I'd rather them sit out a year so that they get their education, they acclimate, they earn their way. But that's maybe not going to fly anymore. However, Bill, if they did it, say May 1st has to be the first day you could transfer, do the transfer portal. That way all the pecking order would then be, Bill, be high school kids, maybe junior college now and then transfer portal. Right now the problem is coaches are going after kids. There's 4,700 kids that are in the baseball transfer portal, probably way, way more in more than that. And so those are 4,700 kids are getting looked at for baseball. In tennis, I don't know what it is in tennis, but if you have to wait till May 1st, well, you're going to recruit the high school kids first instead of the portal kids. So the portal kids, we've seen it prime time this last year. It's easy to take a team. I think it takes a good coach and a good team of individuals working together 4 or 5 years to really reap the benefits. Wouldn't you say, though, so, Bill, if you do everything right, come up through this working hard. But with the transfer portal, it's like an elevator. You get up there quick, but you can sure to fall down the elevator shaft. When it goes bad, you fall down the elevator shaft. And we'll have a few examples of that. We already got a few peaks this last year in the football season of quick rise, quick fall, you know. But the stability that you get by going one step, then another, then another, then another, one step at a time and building the old-fashioned hard work way. Now, it really upsets me at this time. Nobody, probably those TV guys on sports talk shows, not going to listen to my show, but it irritates me to death the way they tell, you know, like Dabo Swinney, oh, my golly, he's old-fashioned, he's going to get left behind. And the other day, I just love what he said, though. You know, he said what his goals are, you know, still to develop these human beings, these young men into men. And, you know, and maybe he'll get burned. He's already been burnt some. But, my golly, he developed, as a coach, as a college coach, Bill, I'm disgusted with what I'm seeing happen in tennis, the sport I coach. It's about 80% international players. In the transfer portal, too, it's like you don't know who the heck's on the other team. I told my guys the other day, I don't even know the players on the other team. I pay attention to you guys, just try to help you get better every day, you know, because they flip so fast, Bill. You know, so
there's no incentive. There's very little incentive to recruit the high school kids. And the kids that really have gotten hurt are the tweeners. So if those of you who don't know what a tweener is the guy that – I've got a grandson that's a tweener, okay? I've got a grandson who's a freshman in college. He was the best – and this is my opinion, but it's not just my – he was the best outside linebacker in the state of Tennessee his senior in high school. He was All-State. He was – but he's a tweener. He's not big enough to be an outside linebacker. He's not, probably not a safety. He's probably not a strong safety. So the deal is he's a tweener. And I wouldn't recruit a tweener if I'm a college coach, and they're not going to recruit a tweener, because if I'm at a Chattanooga or at a East Tennessee State or at a middle, I can pick up a guy that was at Alabama that gets disenchanted, that was an outside linebacker that's got 2 years eligibility left. I can pick him up out of the portal. He's 2 years older. He's made the adjustment to college. He probably isn't what Alabama looked for, but he's probably more than I'm getting out of a tweener.
Yeah.
I'm not taking a chance on a tweener. And so that's kind of what I've done there. And the same way with Alabama, if I'm going to take my superstars, I'm going to take my 5 stars and my 4 stars. But when I get to my 3 stars, I don't know if I want to take a chance when I can pick up that 4-star that's transferring from somewhere else, or that 3-star that's 2 years older, that was at the University of South Carolina last year, but he might have started for them, but he's got higher expectations, and he goes, you know what, I can win a national championship at Georgia, so why don't I think about if I can transfer to Georgia? They need a strong safety, and I've got 2 years experience. They'll take me. I'll get a good NIL deal, and I can play in the same league have a higher exposure and win a championship. And so now the high school kids getting left out, and they're having to find ways to go. Two of the most gratifying stories are the running back from Missouri last year who led the SEC in rushes per yard, who came from a D2 school, went to the University of Missouri and led the SEC in rushes. He's an undersized running back who, I don't even know the kid's name, but he's an undersized running back who is what you're looking at. And then the other kid is this Dalton Connect kid at Tennessee. He's a basketball player who spends 2 years at a junior college, 2 years at Northern Colorado, and goes to Tennessee 1 year and sets the thing on fire. Now, could they do that? Now, and I think the world of Rick Barnes, Rick has been smart enough. He has supplemented his guys. He's got his guys, and his guys have been there. So he's got the nucleus of a senior program, and then he has supplemented them from guys coming out of the portal who fill niches, and these guys have all overperformed. And the interesting thing I heard, and this is a Bruce Pearl thing, and I'm not a huge Pearl fan, but I think Pearl coaches the heck out of basketball. Pearl looks at guys out of the transfer portal that are going up rather than guys that are coming down. So he looks at guys that are at a Wofford or a Chattanooga or that are kind of trying to prove a point and make their point, have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder and are working their fannies off rather than the guy that was at Providence or was at Duke and is coming and is like, I didn't get enough playing time, so I'm going down to Auburn. And he likes those guys that are a little bit tweaked and got a little bit of a chip on their shoulder and are going after them. And I think that is pretty neat about the portal, but I don't think you can build a team out of the portal. I think you can supplement out of the portal. And unfortunately, I don't disagree with Dabo, but it's where we are today in our basketball and football and those sports, it's kind of like when they legalized the forward pass. If you didn't transition to the forward pass, could you survive without throwing a forward pass? And you probably couldn't. Now, I think you have to be very guarded at how you use it, and I think you have to make sure that the people you bring in through the portal meet the culture of what you're building within your program. I think if you compromise the culture of your program, the portal can become toxic, and I think you saw some of that at USC last year in their football program. I think they tried to create a football program using the portal, and I think it became somewhat of a toxic environment. I don't know that firsthand. I'm going as an outsider looking in. I think sometimes when you bring in too many people, there's too much uncertainty, there's too much cultures and backgrounds, that for a team to be successful in a team sport, and I had a coach that said, you know, football is the ultimate team sport because of the number of people you have to do and what you have to do. If you jeopardize the culture, it's going to be very, very hard to win. Belichick, during his great years with the Patriots, had a culture that won. Saban had a culture. Coach Bryant had a culture. Woody Hayes had a culture. Kirby has a culture at Georgia. The culture transcends year in, year out. And that's what you have to be careful when you bring in too many people that are too far in the system. Bring in a guy that's a senior, got 1 year, you know, maybe it works out like it did for Rick Barnes this year, and maybe it doesn't. You know, that's a little bit of a crapshoot, and you got to be really careful of the character and the integrity of the people you bring into your culture, because once you let them in your tent, it's hard to get them out of your tent.
That's without a doubt. Wow, that was so so well said. I want to make one or two more points. I really want you to think about tennis our last 10, 15 minutes here and what we might be able to do. First of all, I wouldn't call your son a tweener or your grandson a tweener. He's going to listen to this. I would say he's got the X factor big time. That there's ABC fundamentals and there is the X factor. But it's hard to measure that X factor. I look for those guys all the time. They're always a joy to coach. But the size thing is something you can't do anything about. you know, with some of the sports. And you're exactly right that as far as being a tweener. But the ABC fundamentals, sometime there, but what you're referring to there at the end was if the X factor isn't there and if a person isn't other people, I always tell my guys, I heard this Lou Holtz thing, and whether or not you're a Lou Holtz fan, he said within the first 10 seconds that you meet somebody, you think, can I trust this person? And then I add on there, you also say, you know, is this person committed to what they do? And you also ask yourself, does this person care about other people as much or more than themselves? Or are they self-centered or other people-centered too? You know, and I think that was it's a very, very good point about it's the old one apple ruined a whole bunch, you know, you know, that's for sure. One more thing, Bill, I wanted to ask you on this transfer portal. I've always thought about it this because really college sports are supposed to be education, entertainment. I don't want to go off on this tangent, but I'd have met, when's the last time we heard about somebody being academically ineligible? What the heck are we doing? Are we dumbing down all the standards there? Anyhow, just something to think about. But what I'm thinking is that when kids can just jump ship, we're recycling a lot of bad habits. What you said about your experience and coming up and having to wait your freshman year, you know, we had freshmen. I remember I played freshman basketball over at Tennessee Tech, as well as tennis. We didn't have to. We could play in tennis, but that first year, you know, you had to wait. But now, kids, if at first you don't succeed, they try something else. They jump ship, change a channel. Those are habits that are hard to break. Once people that quitter, I call it the quitter virus. I always tell the guys, when you give your best, Bill, and you lose, it's like a broken bone. When it heals back twice as strong. It's much stronger. You know, what they call the osteoblast, osteoclast, or whatever. That makes that bone stronger. Okay? However, when you quit and you don't give your best and you lose, folks, you create this virus called it stays with you for life. It's called the Q virus, the quitter virus. And that quitter virus, Bill, we're teaching these kids, we're inoculating them with the quitter virus, Bill. I could see one transfer, but when you jump ship two, three, four times, what are you going to do? Somebody, you're at the party when you're 50, where'd you go to school? And you hold up five class rings. You know, and from the stands, from the people's standpoint who are watching football, you're going, who's this kid playing quarterback? I don't know. He came in from somewhere. He's in there. It's like watching minor league baseball or something. Where'd he come from? Well, he played over in California last year, and then he was here. I mean, what a great story when you hear about the kid who, you know, at Georgia, the quarterback there a couple years ago, Stetson Bennett, you know. Now, he did transfer in from a junior college, I think. But he had to work and work and work and work. So we're recycling bad habits, you know, and how can that be good for the educational values? So I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes on that, but we got to ask you the last 10 minutes about tennis here, Bill. Go ahead. What are your thoughts on the recycling of bad habits?
Two things on Stetson Bennett before you go there. Stetson started at Georgia and then went to junior college and then came back to Georgia. Interesting aside, Stetson Bennett's grandfather was a guy named Buddy Bennett. Buddy Bennett was a secondary coach on the secondary that set the NCAA record and still stands in takeaways at Tennessee.
Wow.
So Buddy Bennett was Stetson's grandfather. Buddy coached the secondary at Tennessee for 1 year, set the NCAA record, and then went to Arkansas. And no one ever worked harder than Buddy Bennett's secondary. We would take bets every day on which defensive back was going to pass out or throw up first. And every day, someone would in practice. They never met in a meeting room. They always met on the field 30 to 45 minutes before the rest of the team. They were the first on, last to leave. And they could break on a football. And if the ball was in the air, it was ours. And it was brutal. And so that was Buddy Bennett. That's Stetson's grandfather. And so anyway, that's an interesting.
That's good.
Anyway, that's great. What was the question? I'm sorry, I got tough.
Recycling bad habits with this transfer
bad
portal.
Habits. Yeah, I mean, you've got to learn to persevere because life is going to give you opportunities. The one thing I do know that oftentimes you learn more from your failures than you do your successes, and if you'll learn from them. I mean, you have two opportunities. When it's like Saban would say, never waste a good loss. And so it's never good to lose, but I can tell you, I've played on a lot of really good teams and was blessed. Okay, in high school, we lost two games. We lost two games the last 3 years of high school. We didn't lose the last 2 years of high school. In college, we lost five games. I can tell you where we lost every game we lost. I can't tell you where we won any game we won. So you know, I always say that you got to hate losing more than you love winning because you don't ever want to feel that feeling again. But you always got to learn from it. You've got to take your mistakes.
That's really great.
You got to take your mistakes and be analytical. So if I can just quit, you know, this is me not being a track guy. I always hated the track guys, the shot putters and the discus throwers and those guys because we had one that was a great athlete specimen that played on the team with me, and he was a javelin thrower, shot putter, and discus guy, and he ended up playing, I think, a year or two for the Cowboys. But anyway, just a specimen of an athlete. But sometimes those guys' ability to adjust because they could just stop. If my footing didn't feel right when I first started my motion, I could kind of stop and start over. You know, I'm in the circle and I take my first turn, I'm just go back and do it again. Well, in sports and in life, you kind of got to adjust on the fly. So, you know, I take a step to the right and the guy goes to the left, I better step back to the left, try to get him, or he's going to tackle the dead burn quarterback. Well, the deal is I've got to be able to adjust. If I can just stop and quit and start over, I'm never learning how to adjust to life's obstacles or opportunities. And so, you know, and there's times that probably starting over is good. I mean, there's times when we probably should start over and maybe get a fresh start. But it's not on a whim, and it's not like – I was with a guy yesterday, actually, he's a physical therapist that works in my clinic here, and he was saying that his son was a basketball player at a NIA school, and he's a freshman, and he was already looking to change schools. He wasn't happy and he was changing schools. And he'd been to the athletic director about entering the transfer portal, and I kind of said, you know, is this the right thing? And there are two things I said, is this the right thing, and is this where, and this is a personal thing, is this where God wants him to be? And I said, you know, sometimes adversity is placed in our path for us to grow and develop. And so, you know, he's been at that school. This is March. He's been there since September. And he's ready to enter the transfer portal, and maybe he should at the end of the year. But has he analyzed it? Is it going to be different if he goes somewhere else, or is he just not willing to push through it? And I said, you know, your son's got to make that decision on his own. No one can make it for him. But he's got to analyze, is this something that is an impasse that I can't overcome, or is it an impasse that I'm not willing to overcome? So, you know, that's
kind of joking. Bill, you ever think about you could have, should have, maybe, I don't know, you'd have been a heck of a coach, but the motivational stuff is great. I want to ask you about tennis now. We've got a situation in tennis, 80% of our kids are from the outside of the United States. Nobody's against foreign kids at all, but there's seats at the table. There's only so many seats at the table, and our American kids aren't getting to play. Consequently, junior tennis is in a fix where if you have your son or daughter, and then the USTA, the way they – everything's so regulated from top down, we need to deregulate it. You have to go play all these tournaments. You have to be wealthy pretty much, and then pretty soon a parent figures out, well, wait a minute. We had the number five ranked kid in the state here, South Carolina, and nobody's recruiting him. There's nowhere to go because the international players have basically taken up all the spots. And at most of the schools, coaches are saying, well, we got to, there's two things. Well, we got to get the best players we can, and these international parents don't bother us because they're just happy their kids are in school. Whereas that American parent couldn't understand what was wrong with their child not developing after they sat on their lesson court for 10 years. And he always, you know, the coach always told him he was going to be an All-American. He's not even getting to play at this middle-sized school. So, I mean, what do we need to do, Bill? I mean, I told the USTA, I said there's a couple things you do need to make an All-American team instead of being all internationals, All-American team, just like Kodak All-Americans used to be for football. You'd have USTA All-American teams. But they ought to incentivize, too. They ought to give coaches maybe a $1,000 stipend for your program for every American kid you recruit or something. They could do that. USTA could do that. Now, schools, you know, they always say, well, they might be lawsuits if you put regulations on people. You know, but the bottom line, we need something to where there becomes an opportunity again. Or, Bill, we've had over 500 college teams dropped in the United States. And tennis was the least expensive sport there is for the most value. My AD told me in 1981, I asked him about, will they be dropping tennis because of the because of all the Title IX stuff, they're going to be so much less money. His answer was they'll never drop tennis because you get most value, least money, you get great graduates who are going to give back to the school. They're to be doctors, lawyers, and usually they're going to be very grateful for the educational opportunity they had, which was very true at that time. So what are your thoughts on that? And, you know, you can take 5, 8 minutes, whatever you want, Bill, but what are your thoughts on that?
That's a couple of things. One is, you know, for college coaches, particularly D1 coaches, where, you know, you can say tennis doesn't matter, but every athletic director looks at the, whether it's a director's cup or whatever, and says, you know, if we
that's the culprit. That was the bad thing. They started doing that. I don't know, but they start keeping the score too. Yeah, go ahead.
If we win tennis, we get more, you know, points, and we win the all sports trophy kind of thing. And so the deal is, you know, I can develop them or I can drive the bus, and I can recruit them because the kids coming from Europe have all played on a professional tour before they come. You know, I live in Athens, Tennessee, and Tennessee Wesleyan University is in Athens, Tennessee, and they recently won the NAIA Indoor National Championship, but nobody on the team speaks English. I mean, they do as a second or third language, but and the coach is from South America, and if I was from South America, I'd probably recruit in South America, but there's a prime example. And we're not talking about Division I. We're not talking about guys that are All-Americans. We're talking about guys that may be the number five guy in Tennessee that if he really wanted to play college tennis, probably should have an opportunity to play at Tennessee Wesleyan, but isn't going to have an opportunity to play at Tennessee Wesleyan because I've got a kid from Brazil or somewhere like that that's superior. Now, you know, until the USTA decides that it's going to get serious about how to help develop athletes to be tennis players, okay, because it's the exception to the rule. I mean, it's a rich kid sport. It's a country club sport. I mean, you know, when I look at 40 years ago or 30 years ago, what I spent on my son's tennis, I mean, I could have sent him to Harvard. You know, so the deal is, I mean, with coaches and travel and everything, and Brad was an athlete, like my grandsons are, but he was an athlete who happened to play tennis. But we don't have a lot of that. I mean, we really don't. I mean, and so, one, you've got to get athletes involved. You know, baseball is suffering that way a little bit too, Chuck, because there's not a lot of baseball being played in inner city, so you do have a lot of athletes that aren't, you know, baseball players aren't athletes like your basketball players and football players and some of these other athletes to the same degree. So what's happened is we've created a void because we failed to develop junior tennis players and we've kind of ignored it, and then we'll get a guy that comes out of happens to play at Ohio State or somewhere and then gets on the circuit and does well for a year or two and But if you look at tennis as a whole, given our population and given our passion for sports, the United States isn't very competitive, really, on any level. We're probably more competitive in women's sports because we have more opportunities for women than a lot of countries do. So tennis worked out pretty well in women's tennis, more so than in men's tennis. But, you know, that's kind of – I have a guy that sits behind me at church. His granddaughter plays at Furman, and she was one of the top juniors in the South and was the top junior in the state of Tennessee in high school last year, and she's playing at Furman now, and that's great, and I'm happy for her. She's doing well. But the reality is, you know, she's not the number one player at Georgia or Tennessee or Stanford. You know, that's somebody that probably has a vowel at the end of their name and is probably from Europe or South America. And it's because because this girl, her father was a college tennis coach, her mother was a college tennis player. Had she not had that, her father was a teaching pro, had she not had that in her family, you know, would she have developed as far as she did? So I think you got to go back and say, okay, how do we develop a junior program that is good? And tennis and our Olympic sports kind of bring it to the forefront. But to be honest with you, most youth sports right now are messed up with these travel teams, people that are making a gazillion dollars running tournaments, and it's an industry. It's not necessarily what's best for the kids, and all parents get wrapped up in their kids. So, and myself included, when my kids were young, and with my grandkids, and sometimes we tend to live vicariously through these kids, and you got people that are opportunistic, that are making the holy heck out of money by taking advantage of this, and basically, in a lot of cases, are pimping out these kids.
Yeah. The kids are the commodity, and I've always thought about that. We had elementary school sports and junior high sports coming up before high school. That was our local thing. We had them at our elementary schools even, football and basketball and baseball and did different sports. We've dropped the ball there. That primarily is because of the way we've handled education. The busing has screwed up neighborhoods so badly. You know, the way we do school systems is just so bad. You know, all of the junior highs, people are afraid of getting sued, so they don't have, you know, little league programs and things that within the school systems like we did and all that. So, yeah, the kids become the commodity with all this travel ball and travel this and travel that, and parents pay the kids become the commodity. It's so we've got a problem. The one thing about – go ahead. Go ahead.
And Chuck, tennis hasn't been a school sport for 50 years, okay?
Right.
Tennis is a school sport, whether in middle school or high school, is a rumor. I mean, you don't have people that have adequate skill set to teach. You know, you have a place like here at Macaulay and Baylor School here in Chattanooga that both have excellent programs and they have real coaches. But when you get down to Cleveland High School or Bradley High School or McLean County High School, they roll the balls out, and so it's a rumor. I mean, and so tennis actually was at this travel kind of deal before these other sports actually got to the level of travel ball they're at today. They were, you know, they back when Brad was young, you had Bolitari and you had Seguso Bassett and you had those places, and then you had that group that Rob Cameron and Milo Cameron kind of put together
were mistakes. So I really, before them, we used to have tennis spread out all over the country. We had pockets of tennis play, you know, everywhere. Knoxville had great players. Chattanooga had the Garys, you know, Nashville had, but what the academy sort of plucked the ripest fruit off of all those trees and took them all down to Florida, and all our role models, you know, that was a problem too.
That's what I'm saying. It was ahead of this travel pay to play. We're going to take the best and make an industry out of it. So it was ahead of these other sports, but it also led to the demise of it quicker than the other sports. So that what you have was, so like with us, we had a group that we kind of mentored that was kind of a hybrid. So you had Cheatwood, and you had Haley, and you had Brad, and you had Patrick Brown, and you had Tarinko, and you had those guys that kind of trained together. And we had a really good group of Southern kids that played at a pretty high level. Every one of them played one or two in college, but that was kind of the end of that era.
You're right.
As that evolved, you know, then you ended up with the academies, and then you had this huge void. I mean, you didn't have the Gearys. You know, you didn't have these guys at these schools. And the public schools, I mean, no offense to public school tennis, but, look, I mean, by and large, it's atrocious.
Yeah, it is.
You're not going to get a player, and at the end of the day, if a kid's getting anywhere, he can't afford to play on a school team because he's getting
No. Work. No, it's really hard, Bill. We've got a lot of stuff there. And, listen, folks, we're about out of time here. I wanted to say, with tennis, guys, if you ever get any great ideas what we need to do, you need to get a hold of your state USTA people. Always send me an email if you want it. chuckcreasy@gmail.com. That'd be fine. I'll take a look at it and see. But we've got to do something. I don't have much power. We need a platform. And Bill, what I said when I talked to you that morning a couple weeks back was, daggone it, you've got so much information. There's so many insights. We need a platform. This platform of American Tennis Today, I'm hoping it goes out there and gets in some people's hands, and they can listen to it and think about your ideas. But we got a battle. We got a battle. And the insights today, I know you've stimulated a lot of thought process, and I'm grateful, Bill, you know, as we sign off here, okay? I really
appreciate it. I appreciate your friendship. I appreciate your contribution to the nurturing of my son and grandson.
That's what we're supposed to do, and vice versa. And thank you, Bill, and God bless you, man, you and your family. And we'll see you next week on American Tennis. Come.